So we started to explore in chapter 3 the intellectual faculties of Chachma and Bina. And it was in this chapter that the Alter Rebbe laid down one of the foundational principles of Tanya. And that is the idea that the mind, with its intellectual faculties, directs the heart and the emotional faculties. We sometimes feel that emotions are stronger than intellect. When you're in a certain mood or when you're feeling something, it's very powerful. And your brain can't switch that off. We sometimes know something in our head, but our emotions take us a different direction and it's very hard to stop. And that's indeed true. Emotions are extremely powerful. But as powerful as they are, ultimately every emotion is directed by our mind. There is some thought, some assumption, some understanding or perspective in our head that is leading our emotion in that direction. It may be a misunderstood intellectual view. It may be a mistake that we're making, a misinterpretation of reality, but there's some intellectual view that is causing our emotion. The emotion is like a raw energy, love, let's say. We have love in our hearts. We're ready to love. What should I love? I'm ready to love. What should I love? That's where the heart is. The heart doesn't have discernment to know what to love. It just has love in it. The love in our heart is waiting for our mind to point it somewhere. Our mind will say, I think this is good. I think that person is good. I think this job is good. I think this place is good. And our heart will direct that way, and this is what I love, because our mind thinks that way. And same with fear and all other emotions. They're waiting. They are extremely powerful. In many ways, they are more powerful in their raw brute strength than our mind is. Emotions are more powerful. But they don't have a mind of their own. They need the brain to direct them. And this is a great gift because it means that we can direct our emotions, that we can direct them where we need them. Our emotions can grow, can develop. We're not stuck in where we were or what our passions were. We can develop those passions to a higher place because the mind can develop. This is what the Alter Rebbe introduced in chapter 3 and started then explaining more in detail how the mind works and the various faculties of the brain. Where does the Alter Rebbe get all this information from? How does he have such a deep insight into the workings of the brain, into our emotions, into the way our inner world works? Remember, he wrote his work almost two centuries before Freud came along and started talking about the subconscious and the various different levels of our mind and our brain. Where did he get his information from? Where's his source? So we could explain this through an interesting story that happened. The Rebbe Rashab, Reb Shalom Dovber, was the fifth in the lines of the Chabad Rebbes. The Alter Rebbe was the first who wrote the Tanya, and his great-great-great-grandson was the Rebbe Rashab. So once one of the students of the Rebbe Rashab came very, very excited to him and said, there's been a new discovery. And this would have been in the early 20th century, maybe the late 19th century, that doctors have discovered a vein that is in the brain, like a blood vessel in the brain, that if you tilt it backwards, it helps you remember things, it jogs your memory, and if you tilt it forwards, it helps you concentrate and focus. It sends the blood in different directions of the brain. So if you go back, then it helps your memory, and if you go forward, it helps your concentration. So the Rebbe Rashab, hearing this, walked over to the bookshelf, and he took out a manuscript of one of the Hasidic discourses of his great grandfather, the Mittel Rebbe, the son of the Alter Rebbe, Rabbi Dovber, and in it, it described a vein in the brain that if you tilt forward, it helps you concentrate. If you tilt back, it helps you remember. And in the Maamar it says, and that's why, when we're trying to remember something, we naturally look upwards. And when we're trying to focus on something, we naturally look down. Because instinctively, we know we've got this, and we use it. And so it says in this Maamar that the brain of Chachma, the power of Chachma, is where our memory is. The brain of Bina is where our focus and concentration is. And this vein, it vacillates between those two brain powers depending on what angle your head is. It said it in this Maamar. And so this the chassid, the person who brought this information to the Rebbe Rashab, was flabbergasted. Here, this is a cutting-edge medical discovery that he's bringing to the Rebbe. And the Rebbe shows that more than 100 years ago, my grandfather, great-grandfather, knew about it. So he said, well, was your great-grandfather a doctor to be able to have this information? So no, he wasn't a doctor. He looked at the spiritual realms and extrapolated from there the physical world. He knew nothing about the inner workings of the brain. All he knew about was the spiritual counterparts of the brain. He looked at the divine world, and as we discussed last week, God made us in his image. So when you understand the divine reality, you can extrapolate down to this physical reality. He had the inner knowledge of the mystical, the Kabbalistic, and the spiritual truths of the upper worlds. And from that, he extrapolated the worlds down here. He didn't know about the vein. He knew about the source of it up there and figured that there must be such a thing down here. And so too with the Alter Rebbe in Tanya. This is where he's coming from. He's coming from a very deep understanding of Kabbalistic truths, of divine realities, which if you or I would read them, we would read them as very esoteric, abstract ideas, mystical ideas of upper worlds and higher realms. But what the Alter Rebbe did, and this is one of his great innovations, was he connected those two worlds, the metaphor down here to the spiritual source up there. And so his understanding, his inner understanding of the way we work of our brain and our emotions and our character, was because he understood the source. We're in God's image. He knew the God, the original, and extrapolated it down here. So at length, he described for us Chachma and Bina, these two intellectual faculties. Chachma being the conceptualization of an idea, the first flash where the idea makes impact with our brain, where we get it for a moment, where an idea hits, and we feel that light bulb moment, as it's illustrated in the comic books, and we feel like we've got the idea. But we haven't really got it yet. It's hit us, but we haven't really got it until we break it down, put it into words, extrapolate, explain, expand upon, and that is Bina. That second step is Bina, where we're bringing it down into our brains, making it a part of us, internalizing it. So with this, we can understand the words that the Alter Rebbe uses. Last week, we spent a lot of time explaining these ideas. Now, when we read them in Tanya, it should make sense. The second last paragraph on that first page, the intellect of the rational soul, which is the faculty that conceives anything, is given the appellation of Chachma. It is called Chachma. So that intellectual power that our soul has to conceive something, to conceive an idea, either an original idea that you came up with, or to conceive what somebody else is telling you, to get the information that somebody else is passing on to you, this is called Chachma. Which, if you take the word chachma and rearrange its letters, it's koyach ma. Koyach means the potentiality or power of ma, what? What is it? The power of saying, what is this? I've got it. That's one way of explaining the words he uses. Koyach ma means the potentiality of what is. Like a potentiality, meaning it's still a bit potential in my mind. It's not fully developed and actualized to the point where I can say I get it and I understand it. It's landed, but it's not quite there. It's still a potentiality of what is. Also, calling it koyach ma, chachma is koyach ma. The word ma also denotes a certain sense of humility or self-nullification. Like when the Jewish people complained to Moses in the desert about the food that they were getting. So Moses said, who am I? Ma, anachnu ma, me and he complaining to me and to Aaron, who are we? Anachnu ma, who are we? We're nothing. Ma means what are we? We're nothing. Chachma is a bit of the power of nothingness. It's the power of making your brain totally nullified and open. It's only really possible to learn something new if you're able to clear your mind for a moment. As long as your mind is full of its preconceived notions, of what you understand already, of the way you look at things already, nothing you hear will be new. You will simply slot in anything you hear into some previous knowledge, and you've heard it all before. The only way to learn new information is to have a moment of ma, of what am I? I'm nothing. Complete openness. We sometimes are in this mode where we're listening, when we're hearing, but we're not appreciating what we're hearing. We're just trying to relate it to stuff we know already. And that's then our natural state, because to learn something new means to change, to be open, to be challenged possibly, to be vulnerable. It's not always easy. And so we would rather, whatever we hear, say, yeah, I know that. I've got that. It's familiar. That's more comfortable. But to really learn, you have to empty your mind, drop all your preconceived ideas, and just hear what's actually being said for what it is. And then you can actually learn something new, a new perspective.
Why is it so hard to do?
Well, because it's changing.
It's challenging. Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's threatening.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. We like to be comfortable. And this might make you uncomfortable. It's also true about coming up with it yourself with a new idea. When you're sometimes grappling with a challenge, it could be a work thing, or something you were trying to work out at home, an emotional issue, something between people in the family, or just trying to work out how to fix something around the house, just being a handyman and trying to fix it. And you grab, how are we going to work this out? What do we need to do? Sometimes you're just thinking like circular, like you're thinking over the same things again, but this didn't work. This is not what's not worked. When do you get the idea of something new? It's when you sort of open your mind, passively almost, to let something new drop in. In Chassidus, it talks about where do they come from, these ideas. It's a fascinating topic. Where do these new ideas actually come from? But that's for another time. But the only way to get a new idea is you almost have to let go of your brain. You know, sometimes you sleep on it and you wake up with a solution. You know, you were thinking, and you couldn't get it. And then when you stopped thinking, it popped in. It's not because not thinking helped. The thinking helped, but it was the not thinking that opened you up for a new idea to come in. This is called the Chachma, the power of Chachma. To learn something new, you have to be a nothing for a moment. You have to clear yourself, open yourself up.
Simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Is that simultaneously like be nothing and new idea? Without being nothing, new idea doesn't...
To be the vessel, to be the recipient of the new idea, you have to just open your mind and be a nothing. I can't, if I'm stuck in myself, I'm only going to hear old ideas. So this is the potentiality of what is the koyach ma of chachma. When, continues the Tanya, when one brings forth this power from the potential into the actual, that is, when a person cogitates with his intellect, you actively break down the idea with your intellect in order to understand a thing truly and profoundly as it evolves from the concept which he has conceived in his intellect. This is called bina. This is where you're taking the idea that which came as like a point, a flash, and you now break it down, bring it down, define it, put it into words, think it over, mull it over, consider it from the different angles. That's called the power of Bina. And this is where some ideas will actually end up being rejected. You know, it was a good idea. When you think it through, it's not a good idea. It's not practical. It doesn't actually make sense. Doesn't fit. Or it does. Or you can expand the idea even further. But you have to go through that second step. It's not enough to just have the idea. You have to break it down in your brain so it rests, so it is absorbed in your mind, so you understand it in your words. Until you do that, it's not yours. So even this idea, right? We're learning an idea right now of Chacham and Bina. We're talking about two very abstract things. We're talking about mental powers. So the chips I can describe, I can show it to you, I can say this is what the chips are. Chachma, Bina, I can't point to it. But I can give examples, illustrations. And as we do that, it becomes a bit clearer. I'll give you an example. There's if I would ask you to open your hand and close your eyes, and I would place a 20-cent coin in your palm and ask you, what did I put in your hand? So you would pretty quickly be able to say, a coin. You'd probably even be able to say a 20-cent coin. How do you know that? You have your eyes closed. Because you felt in your hand something that's round, cold, hard, the size of a 20-cent coin. You know, like it's a familiar object. And so all the information that you gathered from your senses of feeling it in your hand, even without seeing it, you put that information together and the conclusion is I got a 20-cent coin in my hand. That is a Chachma-Bina relationship. The Chachma is the experience of it. I'm getting senses that tell me round, cold, hard. That's the information that I'm getting. Bina then puts that information together and makes sense of it and says, well, what if I've got something round, cold, and hard, what is that? It's a 20-cent coin. I'm taking the information and then I'm applying that information. I'm receiving it with Chachma and then developing it with the Bina. This exact process is a test that is done in certain medical issues where somebody's had, for example, some type of brain injury. That certain types of brain injuries block the passage between Chachma and Bina. So there are people who you would put it in their hand and ask them what's in your hand, and they would say something round, cold, and hard. And you'd say, and so what is that? They wouldn't be able to process the next stage. They'd be able to say something round, cold, and hard, but they wouldn't be able to process what it is. Because due to some damage, the process between Chachma and Bina is not flowing. So I've got the information, but I can't utilize that information. I can't define it. I can't take it to the next step and understand what it is. I can observe it but not understand it. Whereas with a normal functioning brain, immediately, we don't even think about cold, hard, and round. We just think 20-cent coin. The information goes in and it's processed to be defined as what it is. That's how a healthy brain is always working. That's called Bina. Now, in the context of Tanya, we're learning this to understand how we work inside of ourselves. We're trying to develop a relationship with God, a spiritual relationship, to elevate our souls, to become higher, more refined people. So Chachma and Bina are our key for this, because when we study divine topics, when we learn about God, when we learn about spiritual realities, in a way where we use our Chachma to hear a new idea that we didn't know before, and our Bina to then apply that idea to our minds, to develop it and stretch it out and understand it deeply and think about it and contemplate it, it becomes real to us. And that gives birth to an emotion. As he says in that last sentence, these, Chachma and Bina, are the very father and mother which give birth to love of God and awe and dread of Him. If you want to have a feeling towards God, a feeling of love of God, and the desire to do a mitzvah, to do more good, to serve God. If you want to have fear of God, which fear doesn't mean being scared of. Fear means having a sense of awe of God's awesome power, of his authority, that I should do what he says and I should avoid doing what he says not to do. If I want to be inspired to serve God with a feeling, with a passion, with love and fear, which are the basis of emotion, I first have to go through my Chachma and Bina. I have to study and contemplate and think and meditate on these ideas. It has to become real to me. It's not enough to say, well, God is great and he gives us a lot of commandments and we have to do it. You have to think, what does that mean? Who is God? What is God? In our prayers, when we speak about God, it's not just about reciting words, but actually thinking about what we're saying. If we're saying, you know, that God is the creator of the entire universe, heavens and earth and all the things that we list in our prayers that God created, it's not just to state the obvious, but it's to actually, let's think into that, that God is the creator of all, everything, including you and me and the entire world that is around us, everything that surrounds us, everything that happens to us, the things that are annoying us right now, the challenges that we're going through, the things that we think are getting in the way of our life, created by God. The people who have been placed in our life are created by God and put there by God. He's the source of everything. If I don't just say those words, but if I stop and contemplate that deeply, not just with a chachma piece of information, but with bina that actually I relate to, becomes a fact, then emotions will be awakened. And I'll feel, first of all, gratitude to God who has given me the gifts that I have, a sense of fear and awe of God who has absolute control over the universe. And also I'll have a deeper appreciation of the challenges in my life, because they're not coming from somewhere else. It's also coming from God. It's not an accident. That's not random. This person who I have to deal with right now, or this situation that I've come across right now that is happening to me right now, that's not an accident. It's all coming from God, from the same source. And therefore, and that God is good God who cares and loves me and wants the best for me. And if I contemplate into that, I will be forced to look at life completely differently. But not just by saying these words. Anyone can say them, like I just did. I said it. But I still get annoyed. I still get frustrated. And I still get worried and nervous and stressed about things. Why? Didn't we just say that God is behind everything? Okay, we said it. There's something round, cold, and hard in my hand, but what is that? Like, what does it mean? I have to go to the next step and say, well, one second. No, it really means that God is behind everything. And it really means that everything is ultimately for my good, even if I don't feel it right now. And whatever I'm going through, it's meant to be. When those ideas are not just words, but they become a reality for me, then my emotions are completely different.
Is that intellectual or is it emotional? I mean, you know, you can say, God did this. I understand God did this. But why do you have to get emotional about that? It's intellectual.
Well,
you think it.
Because our problem is we have emotions, and our emotions are extremely strong. So I know in my head that God did this, but I'm nervous and I'm scared and I'm anxious and I'm also excited about other things. I'm passionate about things that are actually not good for me. I'm excited about doing things that are not nice, that are not moral, that are not good. So my emotions are pushing me that way. Yeah, my head knows all this information. But if it's not affecting my emotions, I'm living this dichotomized life where I know what's right in my head, but I'm not following up. From the brain to action has to go through emotion. We don't do anything. We don't move. We don't take a move without emotion. I might know in my head that something's right, but if I'm not motivated to go to do it, if I'm not inspired to do it, if I'm not moved by it, I'm not going to do it. certainly when it comes to big things and big changes. You know, many of us don't like conflict. Some people love conflict and enjoy having arguments and being hot-headed. Some people enjoy it. Many people don't enjoy that. But even if you don't enjoy it, you need it sometimes, because the only way things change is when things get heated up a little bit. There needs to be a bit of friction in order for there to be change. This is true in our relationships, in our marriages. It's true in our workspaces as well, and environments. As long as things are just sort of bumbling along neatly and nicely, you can be complacent and comfortable. Things have to heat up a bit to change. And sometimes it's through tension and unpleasant, going through a bit of an unpleasant moment where, in a marriage, for example, where someone's upset at us, our wife is upset at us for something that we've done, and they get upset and they complain. Or, why does it have to be so unpleasant, you know? Like just saying in a nice way that, you know, because saying in a nice way is like, oh, no, it's nice, but you don't change. Whereas when you have a moment of tension, it's not so pleasant, but that's when things really change. You move when you're moved, when you're emotional, when it gets emotional. And so those of us who don't like emotions, who would like to sort of avoid emotions, especially extreme ones, you got to have a bit of it. Of course, not too much. And it can't be that there's constantly conflict and all this very impassioned fighting all the time. That's not going to be good. But a bit of it is always necessary, because emotion is what moves us, what makes us move. If you want to do this within yourself, you can do it through your mind. But mind has a pitfall to it, that the brain and intellect by definition is removed, is objective, cold, dispassionate. That's the nature of the mind. So to get from mind to heart, which is passionate and subjective and involved, there needs to be a step. So here he says, Chachma and Bina are the father and mother. And that metaphor, the father and mother, because Chachma is like the father who gives a seed, and Bina is like the mother who develops that seed into a fully viable being. In the birth of a child, which we said earlier, emotions are like the children and the intellect of the parents. Specifically, Chachma and Bina are father and mother. Chachma gives the seed, the mother develops that seed. The Chachma's contribution is momentary. The Bina is a process, a long worked out process. But without Chachma, you can't have Bina. Without the seed, you can't have the development of the child. But the seed itself goes nowhere unless it is developed within the womb. So Chachma and Bina have that relationship to then give birth to an emotion. Okay. He continues. For when the intellect, the bottom paragraph on the page, for when the intellect in the rational soul deeply contemplates and immerses itself exceedingly in the greatness of God. So here we're talking about understanding, appreciating God. First in your mind, studying it, thinking about it, contemplating it, but contemplating it in deeply and exceedingly, thinking it through and to the point where it's clear to your mind how he fills all worlds and encompasses all worlds. He's leading us through it now, that God is not just God up there somewhere. God fills all worlds and encompasses all worlds. Fills all worlds means that every level, God is there. No matter how low you may have gone, God is there. There's no place devoid of him. There's no experience that he's not in. There's no state of being that God is not there with you. He's in all of those levels. He's everywhere. He fills all worlds. And at the same time, he encompasses all worlds, which means he's beyond all worlds. No matter how high you go, he's beyond that. No matter how high you've reached, there's more to go. You've never exhausted God. You've never reached the end. He's infinite. He's beyond. So there's no person who's so lowly that he's beyond God's reach. There's no person who's so high that you've graduated and you're past it and you know it all. God is on all levels, fills all of experience and is beyond it as well. He's not limited to it. These are ideas, these are concepts. Nice. You know, you can hear it and not know what's going on. You can hear it and understand on a chachma level. Or you can then contemplate deeply. What does it mean to stop and to think? So God fills all worlds. That means like right here too. Fills all worlds doesn't just mean in the galaxies. And it means right here in this moment. Within me, God is here as well. To become aware of that and to think that into that deeply. And he adds, not only he fills all worlds and he encompasses all worlds, but even deeper than that, and in the presence of whom everything is considered as nothing. Which means that ultimately, if you really get the depth of the divine, he's all there is. There is nothing else. Nothing else truly exists. This we touched upon previously as well, and this is an idea that permeates Hasidic thought. The idea that God is the truth of all means there's only God and nothing else actually exists. Our existence as separate from him is just an illusion. Our feeling that we're separate from God is just the way we are made to feel, but it's not actually the fact. The fact is, there's just God. Not that we don't exist, we do exist, but not as separate beings like we think. We're all a part of God's oneness. There is nothing else. If you think into this idea, what were you worrying about? What was on your mind till now that you're concerned and worried about? If you stop and contemplate, only God exists, nothing else exists. Not only is everything part of God's plan, everything is part of God. There's nothing outside of him. Does that mean that, why go to work then? why go to work? Why lock my door? Why eat? Why say hello to anybody? No, because that's what God told you to do. God has told us that's what we have to do. He put us in this world, and he put us in this body, and he gave us in this body a mission to live a normal life and to be productive and look after yourself and the people around you and spread love and good and do mitzvahs. That's what he told you to do. That's, of course, what you have to do. So, of course, you have to go to work, and of course you have to be nice to everybody and do everything. You have to treat everyone with respect. Because God told you, that's what he told you to do. But don't be fooled by thinking that the world as we see it is something separate from God. This is the world that God put us in and challenged us to make it holy. The way we see it down here. That's our challenge. It's a very difficult concept to get your head around because we're on the one hand saying there's only God, on the other hand, but we've got to take the world seriously. It's a contradictory idea. It's much easier to go one extreme or the other. Either the world is real and we've got to deal with the world as it is, or no worries because there's just God and there's nothing else to worry about. We can just sit on a mountain or do what we want and it doesn't matter. Those two extremes are much more palatable. The challenge God gave us is, no, you've got to live in both. You've got to live in both worlds. So you've got an important meeting tomorrow. You've got to present to the boss something that's going to be do or die for you, and it's very serious, and if you don't go well, then it's going to have bad consequences. And if you do go well, this could be your big break. So how do I look at that? I have to put everything I can into it to make it work. I have to put every effort to make this successful. And I have to believe that it's totally in God's hands. And it's all about God and there's nothing else. I have to put all my effort in and take it totally seriously. but I have to be completely calm within myself that it is in God's hands. That's not easy. So I have to work hard, but believing that it's not the work itself that is going to produce the success. God gives success. I've got to do what He says, which is work hard. Not easy. This is what is implied when you think deeply into these ideas. When these are not just like nice theological statements. God fills all worlds, encompasses all worlds, and everything is nothing in front of Him. If you actually think into what that means and apply it to yourself, these ideas are powerful. It transforms the way you look at the world. So what will happen? They'll be born and aroused in His mind, if you think deeply into this, and thought the emotion of awe for the divine majesty, to fear and be humble before His blessed greatness. When these ideas become so real and so deeply entrenched in your mind, it arouses a sense of awe. Like, God is not just this powerful being on a cloud somewhere. God is the truth of everything. And so you're humbled in front of that, which is without end or limit. This is limitless. And to have the dread of God in his heart, you'll feel it. But next, his heart will glow with an intense love, like burning coals, with a passion, design, longing, and a yearning soul towards the greatness of the blessed Ein Sof, the infinite one. Ein Sof meaning infinite. The first there's a sense of awe, but then your love is aroused as well. Because remember, our emotions are just there ready to pounce. They're ready to jump at whatever they're going to jump at. I've got love in my heart. What should I love? Who should I love? What's lovable? If your mind is full of the awareness of God, so first there's an awe, you're awestruck by God's power, but then also your love is aroused, because what else is there to love? God is the truth of everything. So I should be chasing another car or a new phone. That should be my passion. The divine is the truth of everything. What I love in another person is because we have the divine in us. We're all divine. Loving God doesn't mean I don't love people. Of course you love people, because God put those people and created them. They're divine beings as well. But when God becomes a reality for you, so then you want to be a part of that reality. You want to be a part of the truth, of God's truth. This, he says, this constitutes the culminating passion of the soul, what's called closer nefesh, where the soul yearns to be connected to God, of which Scripture speaks, as my soul longs, ye even faints. My soul thirsts for God. Tzamalacha nafshi, my soul is thirsting for God. My soul thirsts for you. This thirst is derived from the element of fire, which is found in the divine soul. Remember, we spoke about the four elements in the animal soul. The divine soul also has those elements. Fire is passion. We have a natural passion in our soul, but to arouse it, it has to be directed. That fire in our soul is to yearn towards God. As the students of natural science affirm, and so it is in Eitz Chaim, in the works of Kabbalah, the element of fire is in the heart, while the source of the element of water is and moisture is in the brain, which is explained in Eitz Chaim, portal 50, to refer to the faculty of Chochmah, called the water of the divine soul. The nature of fire is it's warm, passionate, energetic. It springs upwards. The nature of water is it's cool, calm, and flows downwards. And so these are the two faculties of intellect and emotion. The nature of intellect is that it's a calm and cool type of mood. That when the easiest illustration of it is if you imagine an intellectual person versus an emotional person. We all have both, but some people are centered in their intellect. Others are much more emotional centered. So an intellectual person, what are they like? They're sort of dispassionate and removed. A little bit aloof, a more intellectual person. They're always thinking and analyzing, but it's a bit from a distance, because that's how intellect is. It's just always looking, observing, but from the outside. That's the nature of intellect, cool and calm like water. An emotional person is on fire. they're always involved in everything. They're always consumed by everything, like a fire. They're reactive to everything. But there's a warmth there. There's an energy. There's the passion that the intellectual person doesn't have. Intellectual is removed. Emotion is involved. Intellect is cool and calm. Emotion is hot, burning, and passionate. When you have people who are extremes, you know, extreme intellect, extreme emotion, you see it. Most of us have a bit of both. Tend a bit this way, a bit that way. But we have both. We all have both. So of the elements, the element of fire is in the heart, emotion. The element of intellect, the element of water is the intellect in the mind, which is cool and calm. The rest of the midot, the rest of the emotions, are all offshoots of fear and love and their derivations, as explained elsewhere. He doesn't go into it here, but there are really seven emotional faculties, but he says that really love and fear are the core of all of them. And the rest of them are derivations of that, which another time we'll go into. But there's basically two emotions: attraction, love, heading towards something, or fear, rejection, holding back, moving away from something. Either we want to get close or we want to move away. There are two emotions. We want to embrace something, get closer to it, get involved in it, connect with it, or we want to hold back from it, stand back from it. And we usually see love as positive and fear as negative, but not necessarily. Fear means to give space as well, to be respectful towards. They're both necessary. So here, what the Alter Rebbe has done in these words is given us an insight into the process that's going on inside of us. He's talking about the idea of the divine, which, if you think about it, the concept of God is something that's very removed from us. Infinity. It's not an idea that is familiar. We use the word God all the time, of course, but what do we know about God? What do we understand about God? Well, the whole point of Hasidus from the Alter Rebbe's perspective, and the whole reason he wrote Tanya, is it's not good enough to just believe in God. We have to become familiar with Him. He has to become real to us. And the way to do that is to study what we do know, what He has allowed us to know, what He has revealed to us about Himself. Remember how we spoke last week that if we're created in His image, so that means there is some affinity, there's something we can get to know about Him. And even what we don't know about Him, we should know what we don't know about Him. We should be clear on what we don't know. There was once one of the great Rebbes who lives in Israel, the Belzer Rebbe. He's from Polish background. Hasidic group, not Chabad. Belz is a different Hasidic group. He came to visit the Rebbe in New York, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And in their conversation, the Rebbe asked him if in his yeshiva they study Hasidus, they study Hasidic ideas. He said, no, we rely on faith. We don't study these mystical ideas. We rely on faith in God. And so the Rebbe said, well, we also have faith, but there's believing God and there's knowing God. And the Belzer Rebbe said, but if you know, then you don't believe anymore. You know, like we prefer to have faith as opposed to knowing, because if you know, then you don't need faith. And the Rebbe said, don't worry, God is infinite. So whatever you know, there's infinite you don't know that you can have faith in. In other words, we all need faith, but you want to reserve faith for that which is beyond our understanding. What we can understand, we should. And if we can push that understanding further and have a deeper understanding, we should push it. And you'll never run out of material because God is infinite. But what today for you is taken on faith, tomorrow you could know, you can understand that. And your faith can be graduated to a higher level by getting to know God better. And then when you know, it affects your emotions. Faith doesn't always affect your emotions, doesn't make you move. But knowledge, when you know, it goes into emotion and then it becomes real. But he still hasn't explained that, which is in this last paragraph. That the third intellectual faculty, where does it fit? We've got Chacham and Bina, so why do we need Da'at and what is it? Da'at, the etymology of which is to be found in the verse, and Adam knew Yada Chava. Adam knew Eve. The word Da'at means knowledge. That word is utilized in the story of Bereshit, in the creation of the world, that Adam knew Eve. Now, what that means is, it was understood by the next verse. It said that Adam knew Eve, and she conceived, and she gave birth. So what does it mean, Adam knew Eve? It means that they were intimate. So the word yada, knowing, in the biblical sense, is attachment and union. It means attaching, becoming one, uniting, becoming intimate with. So if that's the word yada, that's how it's used in the Torah. So the word da'at as an intellectual faculty means becoming attached and united with an idea.
Is that the origin of da'at? Yada.
Yeah. It's the same. It's a verb form of da'at. Yodea. Echad mi yodea.
Oh, yodea.
Yeah. Yeah. Yada in the past tense. So what does that mean? That is, one binds his mind with a very firm and strong bond to and firmly fixes his thought on the greatness of the Blessed Ein Sof, the Infinite One, without diverting his mind from him. For even when one is wise in understanding, which is Chachma and Bina, of the greatness of the Blessed Ein Sof, will not, unless he binds his knowledge, Da'at, and fixes his thought with firmness and perseverance, produce in his soul true love and fear, but only vain fancies. Okay. In these very few words, he's introduced this third level of intellect. Sometimes you know something in your head with Chachma and Bina. You've got the information. You know it. You know it clearly. You know it well. But remember, the nature of intellect is removed, is information. And having information is not yet enough to make you emotionally moved by it. You need da'at, which means that information you have to have a connection with. You have to cleave to it. You have to be attached to the information. You have to make it real to the point where it's tangible. It's not an idea. It's a fact. It's a reality that you're connected to. That's what da'at is. And only with da'at will you produce a real emotion as opposed to a vain fancy, a passing emotion. I'll give you an example. There are many examples that we can think of information that we know in our head clearly, and we know it very well, but we don't act on it. It doesn't change us, it doesn't move us, because it's theory. It's an idea that's in theory, but it's not in practice. The classic example is the doctor who smokes. And we've known several of them. That a doctor who on a daily basis sees people who are impacted by smoking, can tell them exactly what the smoking is going to do to them, and yet for himself, doesn't apply. He still smokes. Why? Is it because he doesn't have enough information? Does he need to read another study or another statistic or meet another person who's been impacted by it? No, he's got all that information. It hasn't applied to him yet. It's not because he doesn't know it. He knows the information. He can quote the information, but it's information still. It's not personal. It's not so real that I've got to stop until he gets sick. When he gets sick, now he wakes up. Now it's real. What he knew before, but da'at doesn't just mean knowing information. Dat means being attached to, being intimate with information. Like, it applies to me. It's real to me. The classic story that the Rebbe told was about the little villager, the villager who, back in Europe, who many of the villagers were illiterate. They couldn't read. If they received a letter, they had to take it to the town scholar to read the letter for them. So one of the villagers received a letter from the big city, and he came to the town scholar and says, "Please read. What does it say?" So the scholar looks at it and reads it, and said, "There's very sad news that your father has passed away in the city." And the villager hears the news and faints from shock. So the Hasidim would ask, telling the story, why did the villager faint and the scholar didn't faint? The scholar was reading it firsthand. The villager was just hearing it secondhand from the letter. The scholar who read it immediately, why didn't he faint? Why did the villager faint? Well, it's obvious why. It's his father. For him, he was reading words, information, news. For him, it's not news and information. It's happening to him. It's me. It's my father. So, of course, the scholar who could read doesn't get impacted. It's the villager who, his story that he is impacted by it. That's the difference between having da'at and not having da'at. We're hearing information, but it's not touching us. We are so inundated with information, and we have so much information at our fingertips today. So whatever we may be working on, whether we're working on ourselves or on our relationships or on our work skills or whatever it is, the information we have everywhere. But until it's personal, now this actually means me. It's talking to me. It's not real. Da'at is where you connect to the idea with yourself. You start taking it personally. Sometimes it takes an experience for that to happen. Where now I get it. I've been hearing this all along. Now I'm living it. Now I get it. And sometimes we can do it ourselves. We can actually exercise this power of da'at within ourselves to connect to an idea and make it real. And that's what he's saying here when it talks about our relationship with God, that when you contemplate deeply, not just to understand, but you actually say, no, this is me, this is talking about me. That when God is everywhere, and he's here as well, in my life, and you start to observe that and see how many times have you in the past been in a situation that you thought was terrible for you, and this is not where you wanted to be, and it was pushing in this, and look where it led you. And so it was God, and God did have a plan in mind. It's happened to me. I've experienced it. That's when it becomes real, as opposed to theoretical. That's why, interestingly, in the Amidah, we know the structure of the Amidah is there's three blessings that introduce the Amidah of praise of God. There's three blessings at the end, and in the middle are the requests that we make, things we ask God for. The very first request we make is Chonen Hadat, that you bestow Da'at on us. You give us Da'at. We mention in the blessing, there are different versions and different Sidurim, but we say Chachma Bina Da'at, or De'a Bina V'Haskel in some versions. We talk about the three faculties of intellect within the body of the blessing, but the conclusion of the blessing is Chonen Hadat. Please give us Da'at. Because Chochmah and Bina, it's great. But without Da'at, it's not applied. It hasn't become real.
Can you get to that point of Da'at without having gone through the Chochmah and Bina? To like some things, you know, certain prayers you might, you can read it, you don't fully understand everything about it, but you can sort of try to make it feel personal to you.
Yes. Sometimes we do have an experience where it seems to circumvent Chochmah Bina, where we didn't really understand it, but it hit us somewhere. That can definitely happen. But the problem with missing Chachma Bina is that it might be short-lived. We might be inspired by something or moved by it at that moment, but if we don't contemplate it and make it ours, the emotion comes and goes. You know, so you can hear something really inspiring and it quickly passed. Everything has to go through Chachma Bina, but it may quickly pass through Chachma Bina and go straight to the Daat and then into emotion. But it might not be there tomorrow anymore. You lose it. You lose it tomorrow. Whereas if before, sometimes you even have to slow down the inspiration. Don't get inspired yet. First understand it. Don't get moved by it straight away. Hold back the emotion and keep the intellect for a bit. Analyze it. Let it sink in. Think it through, and then let it seep through emotion. It'll be a much more deeper experience. We can't always help it. We don't always have control over it. Sometimes we have to go back and review it to remember what inspired me, what got me going there. Also, if you do it that way, sometimes you get inspired from a misunderstanding. You know, it's like a person who takes everything personally. Daat is taking something personally, right? It's good. But there's some people who take everything personally. So what does that mean? So everything anyone says was an insult to me. Or you know, you meant me, you're blaming me. It's all about me. Well, hang on a minute. If you listen to what I was saying, I wasn't talking about you. First hear what I'm saying and then develop the emotion to it. You know, don't jump straight into that. So it's a bit of a gift. Daat is difficult for most of us. It's an effort. It's like a flap that can be opened and closed. And that's good. Sometimes we have to hold back. We can't be emotionally taken by everything. We can't be emotionally moved by everything. We'd be a mess. You know, if every piece of information we heard, we took it to heart, we wouldn't survive. Reading the news, if every tragedy in the world that we read about we took to heart, we'd be a basket case. That's why we're able to read the headlines as we're eating our lunch and move on to the next thing. On the other hand, if you're so callous that you can read about all these tragedies and eat and just go and live on your life, you're closing your heart and you become numb. So Daat has to be, we have to be discerning about it. What do we let in and what not? What should affect us, what shouldn't? What do we take personally, what not?
Did you use the word internalize when you're talking about Bina? My understanding was that Daat becomes as one with you. Knows you'd Bina as it's an intellectual process, but the difference is you haven't internalized it. I didn't use the word internalize.
Well, Bina, you intellectually internalize. Meaning, Chachma is a very superficial experience in many ways. Like, I hear the idea, but I haven't internalized the idea in my mind. It hasn't become one with my mind, with my intellect. Bina is internalizing it with my mind, so I can understand it, I can put it into my own words. If you study these ideas, and yeah, I understood it on a Chachma level, if I can't put into my words and explain it on a simplified way, I haven't fully internalized that in my brain. But it's still only in my brain, even if I can. If I can say over these ideas, if I can repeat them in my words, I've internalized it in my mind, but have I internalized it in my heart? Okay. That's the next stage, which is Daat.
The mind and the heart are not separate from each other.
They are. They are separate.
You can't have Chachma Bina without Daat. So it's connected as one entity.
You can. Chachma Bina work very close.
Either way, right?
Not necessarily. That's why we ask for it. That's why we request for Daat, because it can very easily happen that we've got the information, but it stays there.
We're just not aware of it. It's still happening. I turn left, it's happening right. But I only turn left, so I don't... Right's still there.
Yeah, but Dart can be closed. It's a flap that can be closed. And we need to sometimes. Sometimes I need to keep something away. I need to protect my heart. So I can't take this personally. I can't take this in. It's a piece of information. I know it, but I can't take it in. Sometimes I can't help it. And it goes through that, you know, something touches me about the information and I become emotionally moved by it sometimes, but not always. It doesn't always work the way we want it to. Sometimes things affect us that shouldn't or we wouldn't want them to. And the things that should affect us don't affect us. Dart is a skill. It's something that we need to work hard on, which is why we ask for help.
And the only way we get to that help is through that end soft, that fact that it's the only way out, because it has to be infinite. Otherwise it gets...
Yeah, yeah, the God is real.
Yeah, otherwise it gets stuck. It's subjective.
Mm-hmm. Yep. This is why, you know, interesting that... our tefillin has four boxes. The head tefillin has four boxes. So in Kabbalah, it's explained that they represent Chachma, Bina, and Da'at. But that's three. So because Da'at is the opening to love and fear, the two emotional columns. So Chachma, Bina are two, and then Da'at is split into two. Because Da'at is all about emotion. It's not about itself. It's about connecting to emotion, which are the two lines of love and fear. Which is why the tefillin then lead downwards with the straps. The head tefillin has these straps going down from the head down towards the heart.
Mm.
Because they're the two lines of love and fear. And the right one is longer than the left one. Because chesed, kindness and love, is what we want to emphasize. And fear needs to be there, but it's shorter.
Fear lasts longer than love.
Lasts longer?
The way in which, I suppose, I understood for a certain amount of time was that fear of God. But that's with anything. You have that fear just keeps you like on your toes.
Yes. He'll explain that later, how fear has to be the foundation. We have to start with a sense of fear of God's authority. Otherwise the love is just my feeling of love and what I'm into, and you know, it has to be start with fear, but you can't stay there. You have to get to love as well. You have to do it from love, but that will come later. So in summary, we've now become familiar with the three intellectual faculties and how each one of them is necessary. We can't skip any of them if we want to have a wholesome experience. Chachma is the initial hitting of the idea, the striking of the idea, the conceptualization, like the father who conceives, the seed that is the kernel of the idea. But that has to be developed in Bina, the mother, into a fully fledged concept. Not just a fleeting thought, but something that is a viable being, which takes development, mulling over, thinking over, meditating on, contemplating, deeply going into it. But then we're still in the realm of intellect. We've got it, we've understood it, it's in our head. We've personalized the idea intellectually, like we can put it in our own words, but personalizing it emotionally means, but it applies to me. It's reality, it's a real thing that I have to live by. It's not just information about smoking is bad, but it's like, it's bad for me. It means something to me. It's not just that God is this real entity that's an amazing concept, but that like in my life, the decisions I'm about to make and the way I'm going to approach tonight, the way I'm going to go to bed tonight, the way I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning, that's where God is real. And when we take it personally, so then it lifts our emotions. So you start to have a sense of awe of God because he's right there in front of you. And a love for him, because what else should we be embracing?
What would be
the recipe to increase that, or